This is the clerk of the court, Greg Block, confirming procedures for the oral argument scheduled to be conducted by teleconference this morning. If arguing counsel or a judge drops from this teleconference, we will pause the proceeding and clock until the judge and or counsel is reconnected. In accordance with the instructions we previously provided counsel, we will sound a single tone that sounds like this. We can try that again. When counsel has 3 minutes remaining. So a single tone when 3 minutes are remaining. And that double tone you just heard is what will sound when counsel's total allotted time has expired. Arguing counsel in this case are on the call. Mr. Steven Spitzer, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. And Ms. Abigail Shopik, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Please stand by while I confirm the judges are on the call. Presiding Judge Allen, did you hear both counsel, and can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. And Judge Toth, did you hear both counsel, and can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes to both.
Thank you. And Judge Falvey, did you hear both counsel, and can you also hear me?
I did, and I can.
Thank you. Judge Allen, the call is configured, and all participants are now ready to proceed.
Very good. Mr. Black, could you please call the court to order?
I will. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined by Judge Toth and Judge Falvey. We're here this morning via teleconference to hear argument in the matter of Cecil Hembree versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert L. Wilkie, case number 18-3856. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please make your appearance for the record?
Your Honor, Stephen Spitzer from the law firm Bergman & Moore, LLC, for Mr. Hembree. With me on the call are Glenn Bergman and Sunhee Choi.
Thank you, Mr. Spitzer.
Your Honor, this is Abigail Shopik on behalf of the Secretary. Also on the call is Deputy Chief Counsel Christopher Wallace.
Good morning, Ms. Shopik. Mr. Spitzer, I understand you'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes.
We will make that happen. And so if counsel are ready, Mr. Spitzer, you can begin.
May it please the court. The easiest way to resolve this case is to apply Warren. Warren confirmed that the Delisio standard applies to non-hearing withdrawals. Mr. Hembree's withdrawal was also non-hearing. Thus, Warren controls. But if this court doesn't find that Warren controls, it should clearly state that Delisio applies to non-hearing withdrawals for two reasons. First, because of how the Federal Circuit has explained Delisio's purpose, and second, because of the source of the full understanding requirement. I'd like to talk about how Section 20.204 creates two different rooms, Delisio's purpose, and the source of the full understanding requirement. We can think of Section 20.204 as laying out two rooms, the hearing room and the non-hearing room. Warren dealt with an alleged withdrawal in the non-hearing room. And for that non-hearing alleged withdrawal, Warren applied Delisio and found it insufficient to meet that standard. Mr. Hembree is also in the non-hearing room. Thus, as Warren confirmed that the Delisio standard applies to non-hearing withdrawals, Delisio applies to Mr. Hembree's non-hearing withdrawal.
Mr. Spitzer, this is Judge Allen. If I could ask a question. So you have divided the world into things at the hearing and things not at the hearing, basically. But wasn't the issue in Warren that led the court in that case to apply Delisio is that although the thing was in writing in the sense that somebody literally put pen to paper, it was actually a VA employee who was recounting what the veteran in that case purportedly told the VA employee. And so the court, as I understand, Warren, analogized that to essentially the back and forth in a way that could occur at a board hearing with a board member. And so the distinction then in Warren wasn't just that it wasn't at a hearing, it was that it actually, the main point was that it was to a VA employee as opposed to being something submitted by a veteran in writing or the veteran's representative.
No, Your Honor, and there's both a regulatory reason and a qualitative reason. The regulatory reason is that the demarcation line in 20.204 is hearing or non-hearing, or hearing and everything else. If Warren was treating the withdrawal as in the hearing room, it would have had to be explicit, because it would have had to rewrite the regulation from on the record at a hearing to on the record at a hearing or something like a hearing, or interpret contacting a VA official as a hearing, which would not comport with statute, regulation, and this court's case law. Even if the court did do that, it would have had to be explicit. It did not do that, and so treated it in the non-hearing room. There's also a qualitative reason, too, because the contact in Warren and the contact here were both one-way communications. They were information presented from the claimant to VA. It is then different than the two-way communication at a hearing where the veteran's law judge or the hearing officer is presenting information to the claimant and the claimant is responding. So both from a regulatory sense and a qualitative sense, both Hembree and Warren are in the non-hearing room. I'd like to then move to a CRE. In a CRE, the Federal Circuit explained that Delisio's purpose is to prevent veterans from being confused by the nature of the VA process and unwittingly withdrawing their claims. That purpose applies to all withdrawals. The potential for pro se veterans to become confused and unwittingly withdraw their claims is a problem which exists regardless of the form of the claim withdrawal. And this is a problem which will only become more acute as appeals modernization introduces more tracks and lanes and streams, sometimes requiring veterans to withdraw one type of review to proceed with another. Thus, in this pro-claimant system, the court should protect veterans' basic rights to understand the consequences of a claim withdrawal.
Counsel, this is Judge Toth. Couldn't we apply the regulation and basically protect against inadvertent withdrawals just by requiring the board to read the veteran's statements narrowly? If to the extent that there's any ambiguity, they could draw an inference against withdrawal. Right. This is what happens, in contract law, whenever there's sort of, one party is deemed more sophisticated than the other, the court would just read a written submission narrowly for the benefit of the, less sophisticated party, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be helpful to the situation. But as I'll continue, there is a full understanding requirement implicit in this regulation. If by reading narrowly, the board is
in your world, and sorry to slow you, but where there's two universes, there's at a hearing and not at a hearing. To fully suss out the subjective understanding, it would require a number of back and forth communications, right? And I'm just wondering practically how that could happen.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I'll explain why. Because determining full understanding would require no more than adding language to a form that VA already has to send out. The M21-1 requires that upon receiving an alleged withdrawal, VA must send out a withdrawal of claim letter. And this says that VA has processed the alleged withdrawal and that VA can reverse the action if the claimant responds in 30 days. So all it would require is revising or adding language to that same letter to fully explain the consequences. Then if the veteran did not respond to that letter with the consequences, That would give the board the record basis to say that we explained the consequences, he didn't or she didn't object, so the veteran understands the consequences. I'd like to move then to the full understanding requirement. It came most recently from the cases cited by Delisio. The cases cited include Hansen and Verdon, which dealt entirely with written withdrawals, and Coleman, which dealt partially with written withdrawals. However, the source, the foundation of that requirement, is in the Due Process Clause. Applicants for VA benefits have a property interest in benefits. And when the board denies an appeal, just like they did here, they deprive a claimant of entitlement to benefits. Now, the board can make that deprivation, but it has to be done with due process of law. Due process includes the basic rights of notice and a hearing. Those due process rights can be waived, but as this court held in Clark v. O'Rourke, waiver of a due process right must be voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently made, or must be an intentional relinquishment of a known right or privilege. That comes from this court's recent decision in Clark v. O'Rourke, 30 VetApp 92. For that proposition, Clark cites cases from this court in Del Rosario v. Peek and Janssen v. Principi. Janssen is particularly important because it is the first time that the full understanding phrase surfaces prior to Delisio. The court was referencing cases and explaining that a right could not be waived because the attempted waiver did not reflect a full understanding of the consequences. Also supporting that proposition are cases, our Supreme Court case.
Thank you. This is Judge Falvey. This argument, the due process argument, and I'm pretty certain the Warren argument, that Warren is controlling, this is your first argument, I guess. Neither of those arguments were made in your opening brief. These are new arguments. Why should the court entertain these new arguments?
Your Honor, addressing Warren was made in our reply brief in response to the Secretary. As far as it not being in our opening brief, I apologize for that. As far as the due process argument, our briefing was completed before this case was sent, before Shoemaker was sent to panel. After the oral argument in Shoemaker, which we did listen to, it's clear that this case gained complexity and the court was looking for the due process roots of the full understanding requirement. So this is helpful to provide an answer to those questions.
Thank you.
I dropped off right after my question when I should have hit the mute button and hit the hang up button. Like Ms. Shopnick. Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Spitzer, why don't you repeat your answer to Judge Falvey's question, and then I have a follow-up if he is satisfied with the answer.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as Warren, we made that argument in our reply brief in response to the Secretary's citation. I apologize for it not being in our opening brief. As far as the due process issues, our briefing was completed before Shoemaker was sent to panel. After the oral argument in Shoemaker, which we did listen to, it became clear that the court was looking for and interested in the due process roots of full understanding. So we would like to provide an answer to the court's questions from Shoemaker.
Judge Falvey, do you have a follow-up?
Not on those lines. Thank you.
Mr. Spitzer, I too was going to ask you the question that Judge Falvey did. I'm looking at your opening brief. It actually doesn't cite, you've acknowledged it doesn't cite Warren, but it also doesn't cite the Constitution. And while I appreciate the fact that Shoemaker, which I have some familiarity with, came later, not to be flippant, but the Due Process Clause has been around since 1791. So this is not new authority. And so it really does put the secretary in quite an awkward position to be hearing this argument for the first time, not to mention the three judges who put some effort into this. So you may want to think even more and talk to us on rebuttal about why we should exercise our discretion to hear either one of these arguments.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, and I would offer that if you'd like us to submit supplemental briefing, we will. We were trying to be responsive to the court's concerns in Shoemaker. Our position from the opening brief is unchanged, that you could apply Delisio on its face, and you could also apply Warren from our reply brief. Additionally, we still maintain the argument that even under existing law, even under 20.204, Mr. Hembree's statement was not explicit and was ambiguous because of the issues we've pointed out. But if the court would request supplemental briefing or other additional information on our due process arguments, we're happy to provide that.
So this is Judge Toth. Why don't you run by, again, the arguments as to what would render these statements ambiguous?
Yes, Your Honor. In the October 2009 report of general information, Mr. Hembree requested that VA take action on his claims. If he understood that his appeal ceased to exist in September 2008, he would not have asked VA to do something with it in October 2009. Additionally, along with the September 2008 statement, he submitted an employment questionnaire, which reflected that he wanted to continue with his claims in some part. Additionally, in the cover letter from the Veterans Service Officer, this is at record at 1090, it says that the September 2008 statement and the employment questionnaire were being submitted in support of the pending claim for benefits. Additionally, the September 2008 statement itself at record at 1089 says that it was a withdrawal of claims and appeal. Appeal is singular. Yet the board provided no analysis pursuant to 20.204B1 concerning multiple issues on appeal. In addition, as the court held in, the Federal Circuit held in Acree, the Delisio test cannot be applied flexibly, that the board needs to make findings on all three elements, irrespective of explicit or unambiguous, and irrespective of any indication of lack of understanding.
But didn't he ask VA to take no further action on an Agent Orange claim in that October of 2009?
Yes, Your Honor. But the Agent Orange appeal, the only Agent Orange appeal filed prior to that would have been the claims filed in May 2007 that we're discussing here. Additionally, I would note from that document that he said that he did not want to pursue benefits due to health reasons, which reflects a lack of understanding because the VA process continues regardless of a claimant's health. I would like to continue and make a few additional points on due process, that the parallel language from Clark and the Supreme Court's decision in Brady finds that waivers of constitutional rights not only must be voluntary, but must be knowing, intelligent acts done with sufficient awareness of the relevant circumstances and likely consequences. That likely consequences language parallels the language from Delisio.
Mr. Spitzer, so what should the board member have done here to meet that standard? It strikes me that if a defendant in a court martial wants to plead guilty, they have to appear in front of a judge. They have to the judge then goes through a lengthy inquiry with them about the voluntariness of their plea, whether or not they understand that they'll be giving up certain constitutional rights, there'll be no trial, there's no right to confront the witnesses against them, and then they have to go under oath and provide a factual basis for their plea, agree that no one's forcing them into pleading guilty, that they're doing this voluntarily, et cetera. So a lengthy inquiry. So are you suggesting that any time a veteran wants to withdraw a claim, the VA, acting oftentimes through non-attorneys before the board process, has to go through this sort of lengthy inquiry to find out this is a knowing, voluntary waiver of their rights?
Your Honor, I don't believe it would be that lengthy because, as I noted to Judge Toth, all it would really require is adding language explaining the consequences to a form that VA already sends out. Additionally, following up, contacting a veteran wouldn't be burdensome. A Cree said that it wouldn't be burdensome, even where a veteran is not at a hearing, to contact the veteran and ascertain their intentions and understanding. The Federal Circuit said it wouldn't be overly burdensome. Additionally, VA has promulgated regulations at right now at 20.904D1, which sets up the process for contacting veterans to clarify issues. And then additionally, it really wouldn't be VA chasing down veterans. It would be the opposite. Veterans would chase down VA. Because where veterans really do understand the consequences and really do want to withdraw their claims, they're going to have a reason for doing so. So they will want to make sure that VA understands that they want to withdraw their claim, they understand the consequences, and so the withdrawal will be effective. I'd like to bring up just one other regulatory provision, which I think works by analogy. So 20.704E deals with withdrawals of hearing requests. And 20.704E, like 20.204, sets up some administrative requirements. It specifies who can withdraw a hearing request and where they have to be sent. And yet, in Del Rosario v. Peek, this court held that waiver of the right to a hearing must be voluntary and knowing. So that requirement is added to the administrative requirements of 20.704E to comply with due process. The court should do no more than the same thing here. And with that, Your Honors, if there are no other questions, I would like to resume on rebuttal.
Judge Toth, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Valdi?
No, I can wait. Thank you.
And then we'll hear you on rebuttal, Mr. Spitzer.
Thank you, Shopik, Your Honor.
Ms. Shopik, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The question at issue here, whether appellant withdrew his appeal of a June 2008 rating decision, is immaterial to the outcome in this case. Claimants are required to file a valid NOD within 1 year of a rating decision in order to initiate an appeal. That was not done here. Appellant was informed by the RO that his attempted NOD was inadequate and would not be accepted. In response, however, he never filed a proper NOD. Thus, the June 2008 rating decision is final, no matter whether appellant's claim withdrawal is or is not accepted. As the question of withdrawal is immaterial in this matter, the court should affirm the decision on appeal. Notwithstanding the issue of finality, Delisio does not apply to this case. In a Cree, the Federal Circuit, when discussing the standard from Delisio, that withdrawals need to be explicit, unambiguous, and done with a full understanding, called it the Delisio standard for verbal claim withdrawal. That standard does not apply to written withdrawals. In his brief, appellant attempts to assert that neither Delisio nor Cree distinguishes between oral and written withdrawals. He is, however, mistaken. Critically, the Federal Circuit, in footnote 2 of Cree, explicitly stated that because the facts of that case only implicated verbal withdrawal, it was expressing no view as to the standard for written withdrawal. The court also specifically noted that 20.204 sets out requirements for written withdrawal and distinguished those requirements from what this court said in Delisio. Moreover, during the oral argument in Cree, one of the judges explicitly stated that he believed and assumed the other judges were in agreement with him that if Mr. Acree had submitted a written withdrawal, there would be no further inquiry necessary by VA as to the withdrawal. Even if appellant was correct that the cases did not distinguish between oral and written withdrawals, the regulation, 20.204, very clearly does. As discussed, 20.204B1 states that, except for appeals withdrawn on the record at a hearing, appeal withdrawals must be in writing. It then goes on to establish the form and substance of written withdrawal, including
counsel,
the veteran's name and
code. I had a quick question. So, I mean, the regulation you cite has some guidance as to the content, but, you know, the types of things a veteran have to communicate to withdraw, but the regulation doesn't really speak to ambiguity, right? And very often, or, you know, sometimes at least, these statements are less than clear maybe as to the scope or the clear intent to withdraw. What do we do with ambiguity under the reg?
Your Honor, I think that the ambiguity can be read into what the reg says, that if there is confusion as to what a veteran is saying, that at that point, VA would have an obligation to follow up and determine whether the veteran intended to withdraw. So that we do say is essentially written into the reg.
This is Judge Falvey. I've got a follow-up question along those lines, I think. It strikes me that this scenario, Mr. Hembree's situation, is a lot like Hansen and Warren. And in Hansen, the court, in essence, said that there was no evidence to suggest that Hansen was misguided or lacked an understanding, and therefore the withdrawal, the non-hearing withdrawal, was effective. And then in Warren, really looking at the same thing, looking at the totality of the circumstances, all the communication, they found evidence that suggested there was some confusion. And thus, remand, I guess. Isn't that what we should be doing here, looking for? Is there an unambiguous withdrawal? And is there anything of record that suggests that the veteran lacks understanding of the consequences of that action?
Your Honor, in cases where there's a question regarding whether a veteran withdrew his claims, as you noted, this court has routinely looked to the surrounding circumstances of an appeal. And in this case, the surrounding circumstances favor affirmance. The veteran in this case typed a withdrawal, and through his VSO, he submitted that to VA. The only communication afterwards, there was a communication where he only discussed his TDIU claim, which was not withdrawn. And then there was no communication until the October 2009 communication, when he again communicated that his claim should be withdrawn. In this case, there was no further communication with Mr. Hembree until 2011, when he filed a new claim. And even after the RO granted service connection and assigned an effective date, appellant did not disagree with the effective date based on his current assertion that he didn't intend to withdraw. In fact, it's important to note that prior to his appeal to this court, appellant has never indicated that his September 2008 statement was not actually intended as a withdrawal, or that he did not understand the consequences of his actions. The only instance of record where appellant expressed his displeasure with the assigned effective date was the NOD he filed as to the March 2012 rating decision, which was the decision that assigned the effective date. In his disagreement, he only appears to disagree based on either the fact that he received treatment for his condition prior to the assigned effective date, or a mistaken belief based on an article that he submitted pertaining to NEMR claims that he might be entitled to an earlier effective date because NEMR veterans who filed claims prior to 2009 may be entitled to earlier effective dates. But appellant here is not a NEMR veteran, and nowhere did he ever assert that he didn't intend to withdraw his claims, or that he didn't believe that he had withdrawn his claim, or that there was any ambiguity as to whether he had withdrawn his claim.
Ms. Shopik, can I jump in to follow up with Judge Valley's question? I just want to make sure that I am clear about VA's position on this point. So when you take Delisio and ACRI, if that's how it's pronounced, the Federal Circuit made clear in ACRI, in situations in which Delisio applies, the three factors have to be considered in each of those cases. You'd agree with that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so what if we were to say, okay, Delisio's full understanding requirement doesn't apply to these written withdrawals in the same way, meaning you have an affirmative, UVA have an affirmative obligation to consider full understanding in every case. But instead, and I think this was Judge Falvey's question in some sense, which is, but UVA, even in the absence of Delisio applying, couldn't ignore evidence that suggests there was a lack of understanding. Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Okay. That was actually a very important question for me because those are two analytically different things. Under Delisio, it is an affirmative obligation in every case to consider the question. It's something different to say, even though we don't have an obligation to consider it in every case, if the veteran submitted a document on day one that says, I withdraw my appeal, and on day two called in and said, hey, how is this appeal going? The board couldn't say, oh, no, too late. It's out the door if it determined that that might be evidence that he didn't understand what he did.
Yes, Your Honor.
The VA would be okay with a rule like that.
Your Honor, as the regulation says, withdrawals are effective when received by VA. But if there is ambiguity that is brought in later, such as you just said, you know, a veteran submits something a day later, a week later, or whatever, that indicates some indication that that withdrawal was not intended, that's the point at which VA has an obligation to determine what was actually intended by the veteran. But as noted in this case, there has never, until the appeal to this court, been any indication that appellant didn't intend to withdraw his claim or didn't understand what he was doing when he withdrew his claim.
Thank you for that answer.
Ms. Shopik, Judge Falvey, let me ask you about that then, because at the time he withdrew or reportedly withdrew, September of 2008, I think it was, just a few days later, his Veterans Service Organization representative submitted a letter that said veteran wishes to submit employment questionnaire and withdraw all pending claims and appeals. And there it's plural appeals, but what the purpose of the employment questionnaire? Why was that being submitted? Was the Veterans Service connected for any disabilities at that time? To associate
Your Honor,
a TDIU claim with? I mean, that questionnaire's only purpose is to support a TDIU consideration, but you need to be service connected.
Yes, Your Honor. At the time of the purported withdrawal in 2008, the veteran was service connected at 60% for a lumbar spine condition. And as you indicated, the withdrawal was submitted, and there was also this statement by the VSO regarding the employment questionnaire. These were all submitted jointly. So the VSO submitted the cover letter indicating that appellant wished to submit this questionnaire and withdraw all pending claims. The employment questionnaire was submitted, and the statement that was typed and signed by appellant was submitted. So in total, VA determined that appellant wished to continue a claim for TDIU, which it proceeded to adjudicate, and that he wished to withdraw pending claims. And so that was how VA proceeded on that.
All right. So that reference to submitting an employment questionnaire doesn't raise any ambiguity in your mind?
No, Your Honor. And I think that is reiterated with the further communication that appellant contacted VA a few months later only to check on the status of his claim for TDIU. And then when he contacted VA in October of 2009, he again indicated that he wished to withdraw any claims. So there's nothing that indicates that he had any ambiguity regarding the withdrawal of the other claim.
So that the one a couple months later, that's December 10th, 2008, record at 1081?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that reads that all need to check.
Check claim for IU.
Okay.
So he was only checking on his claim regarding individual unemployability. And in the cases that have preceded this, where this court and the Federal Circuit have indicated a need to look at the surrounding circumstances, one of the things that has been noted are instances where a veteran contacts VA to follow up regarding other claims or other adjudications that may be pending, but does not mention the claims that were purportedly withdrawn, as was the case here.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions, Your Honors, we would submit that the court should affirm the decision here and on appeal.
Before you, Ms. Shopek, this is Judge Allen. Do you have a position about the argument advanced about Warren and the Constitution in terms of the waiver of those arguments for purposes of citing the appeal?
Well, Your Honor, we would submit that, as you noted, the arguments as presented today by appellant's counsel were not raised in the brief. Regarding Warren, we believe that this case is distinctive from Warren. There are a few reasons why we believe that. In this case, the phone conversation, which essentially is the only thing that would make it analogous to Warren, occurred more than a year after the initial attempted withdrawal and also more than a year after the rating decision in question. So the withdrawal in this case that's at question is the initial written withdrawal and not the phone conversation that happened nearly a year later. The court in Warren did distinguish from Hansen, noting that there was a difference between talking to a social worker and talking to a VA employee. But the court didn't determine that speaking with a VA employee over the phone was analogous to a board hearing. What the court determined in Warren was that looking at the other circumstances surrounding the matter was what was necessary. There, the surrounding circumstances indicated that Mr. Warren did not appear to have wished to withdraw his claims. He only wished to withdraw certain claims from DRO review. But here, as previously discussed, all of appellant's actions signify that he wished to withdraw his pending claims. As to the question regarding the due process clause, as you noted, that was not raised. It appears that the language in Delisio, the full understanding language, was not based on the Constitution, but rather based on the court's interpretation of case law at that time. There is a longstanding principle that courts should avoid addressing constitutional questions when it's not necessary. So there's no reason to assume that this court in Delisio made a constitutional determination when it crafted that language. You would assume that if the court was intending to base its determination on the Constitution, there would have been a citation to the Constitution or at the very least citation to constitutional cases to support the position. But that was not done. So we can only assume that the determination that was made by the court there regarding withdrawals made verbally was made based on the court at that time and their interpretation of the case law.
Thank you. And if you could put up with me for one more question.
Of course, Your Honor.
Because, as you know, if you've listened to the first argument in this legal issue, the Shoemaker case, I have been particularly interested in sort of the source of where different courts got this rule. The Federal Circuit in ACRI did provide justifications for its decision to adopt the rule. And what I'm interested in is your reaction to what we do with the fact that the justifications the Federal Circuit provided, the labyrinth in VA system and all of the pro-veteran system, those apply with equal force what the rule, what the situation is. And so I want to give you a chance to respond to what do we do with that information from the Federal Circuit.
Your Honor, I think, as you said, the Federal Circuit did indicate, you know, the labyrinth and system and the complexities that are involved in a VA system. However, there is a difference between a veteran making a withdrawal at a board hearing where, you know, he could just be upset about something or just off the cuff indicate, I want to withdraw something or not necessarily understand what he's doing, and the fact of a person putting into writing and taking the steps, the deliberate action to withdraw an appeal in writing. A veteran who wants to withdraw something in writing, it's not going to be just an off-the-cuff spontaneous reaction. He has to have made a deliberate determination to do that. He has to sit down and write out that withdrawal or type it out, as was the case here. Find postage to send it to VA or get it to his service organization to submit. So there has to be a number of steps that a veteran would have to go through in order to withdraw. And it's assumed that the veteran understands, you know, he's decided for whatever reason that he wants to withdraw his claim. And on its face, you know, VA is willing to accept that unless there is evidence submitted at a later time or in conjunction with it that indicates some sort of ambiguity. If a veteran clearly indicates a desire to withdraw and has taken the time to write it out and has made those deliberate steps, then VA, you know, it's assumed by VA that he understands what he's doing.
Thank you. Judge Toth, do you have any further questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Judge Falvey?
I do. Can we take anything from, as best I can tell, the veteran did not argue that he did not intend to waive or withdraw the claims. Am I reading that right? They're
yes,
not
Your
arguing
Honor.
That?
Your Honor, the veteran in this case has never indicated that he did not intend to withdraw his claim until his appeal to this court.
Can we read anything into that?
I think that what the only thing I would say could be read into that is that he did intend to withdraw his claims, and he's never indicated otherwise.
Do we happen to know whether the veteran in, and I'm sure we can find this out, but the veteran in ACRI, I don't know if it was a gentleman or a woman, whether he or she had indicated before the agency that they didn't intend to withdraw their appeal? Do you happen to know that?
Your Honor, in that case, if I'm remembering correctly, the purported withdrawal was done at a hearing, and I believe that the board decision in question followed that hearing. So it would have been the, I apologize if I'm mistaken about that, but
No, I think you're right.
So in that case, there wouldn't necessarily have been an opportunity for the veteran to have expressed that, because the first time that he would have seen anything regarding the withdrawal or what the board member determined was a withdrawal was in that board decision that he then appealed to this court. But in this case, the purported withdrawal occurred in 2008. That decision became final. And in the meantime, you know, he submitted a claim in 2011, which was then granted, and service connection was granted with an effective date in 2011. And in the preceding time, he never indicated that he didn't believe that his claim had been withdrawn.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Then, Ms. Shopik, if you have anything else, you can definitely tell us, or if not, we can thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. As noted, we would ask that the court affirm the decision on appeal.
Thank you. Mr. Spitzer, you have some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to address the Secretary's point that Mr. Hembree never expressed that he did not intend to withdraw his claims. In that NOD, the April 2012 NOD that the Secretary referenced, record of 2015, he said that he filed prior claims prior to October 2009, which reflects he did not understand the consequences of withdrawal. To answering Judge Falvey's question about the employment questionnaire, that does go to elements of the service connection claims. It goes to current disability, because if he's showing that he was not working, he's showing that he's currently disabled, that goes to service connection. Going to Judge Allen's question about ACRI, from the Federal Circuit decision in ACRI, it does not appear that the appellant explained there that he did not understand the consequences of withdrawal, and he could have done that because he had the hearing. He could have argued that, but he did not. Additionally, all of the Secretary's arguments about Mr. Hembree's understanding are all post hoc rationale. There is evidence of ambiguity, but the board addressed none of it. The board simply said on record at 5, he withdrew, and at record at 7, he withdrew. Additionally, as far as effective when received, that provision refers to when a valid withdrawal is effective. If it's not a valid withdrawal, it's not a withdrawal at all. It's just a piece of paper. The way to look at that provision is, yes. Yes, Mr. General.
This is Judge Falvey. Did the VA send him anything saying, thank you, your claims are hereby withdrawn, or
no, Your Honor.
acknowledging receipt of your withdrawal, this case is closed, you know, nothing?
No, Your Honor, they did not, despite the M21-1 requiring VA to send that withdrawal claim letter.
Thank you.
The court also discussed ambiguity, and that does go to the larger point of cases discussing waiver. The secretary talked about that just because it's written, that indicates a deliberate action, and ACRI's reasoning indicates that there's no basis to say that. With the labyrinthine process of VA, veterans can become confused, whether it's due to a cognitive issue, because they're unrepresented by an attorney, which Mr. Hembree was in this case. So per the court's case law on waiver, the source of the confusion doesn't matter. If the action is not knowing, not voluntary, not intelligent, then it is not a valid waiver or a withdrawal.
Counsel, this is Judge Toth. I wanted to ask if you could speak to the argument about that a proper NOD was never filed, so that even if a withdrawal wasn't effective, that there really was no NOD filed in this case. Can you speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Whether the NOD is valid is an appealable issue that's considered by the board. Here, the board implicitly found the NOD valid because it moved on to the withdrawal issue. Even if the court does not find that the board found it implicitly valid, it should do so as a matter of law. Mr. Hembree stated, I disagree. He identified all of his claims and also his medical claims and expressed a desire for review. That's all that's necessary. In any event, the secretary conceded that there was prejudice, that if the finding on withdrawal was ultimately wrong, VA would have to re-adjudicate the earlier effective date. And in there, the board would need to address whether the NOD was valid. Additionally, Your Honors, again, this is, you know, consistent with the court's case law on waiver concerning intelligent waivers. And what I would also point out about that April 2012 NOD is he's saying that he filed claims prior to October 2009. If he understood that his claims ceased to exist, that would not have been filed. If there are no further questions, in conclusion, Mr. Hembree requests that the court vacate and remand the board decision to address whether the alleged withdrawal was valid. Thank you.
Judge Toth, do you have anything else?
I don't. Thank you.
Judge Falvey?
I don't. Thank you very much.
Well, the court wants to thank counsel for participating in the unusual argument. We appreciate it, and the case of Hembree versus Wilkie is submitted.
The court is now in recess.